Mako jail 6 minutes after the wall had been broken. Outside the walls, the covering force dug in and waited for a counterattack from the British garrison. The troops and plainclothes men, already in the city, were stopped by the Maccabees, who controlled the entrances from rooftops and alleyways. When all 200 men were inside the jail, they turned to smashing open the cell doors and freeing the prisoners. The escapees, Arabs and Jews alike, were ushered to the breach in the wall, and soon they were running in every direction through Aku. Ari led 5 men with the captured turnkey to the death cells and the hanging room. The turnkey began to open the door. Inside, the 4 guards, who kept constant watch on the condemned pair, began to fire at the iron door. Ari waved the others back, slapped a magnetic mine on the door, and ducked back. The door was ripped from its hinges. Ari stepped into the doorway and hurled a grenade inside, and the guards fled to the hanging room. The party quickly entered, pinned down the guards, and opened the cell doors. Akiva and Dov Landau were rushed from the prison, across the bathhouse roof, and through the bathhouse to the outside. Dov Landau was pulled aboard a truck filled with men. Ben Moshe waved to them to move out, and the truck sped off toward Naharia. 2 minutes later, the staff car pulled up, and Ari led Akiva into it, and they fled in a different direction. Ben Moshe blew a whistle signal for the Maccabees to begin the withdrawal operations. It was a mere 21 minutes since the blast of the wall. Confused units of the British garrisons attempted to converge on Aku Jail. They were stopped by landmines, roadblocks, and crossfires. Inside Aku, disorganized British units were trying to chase the 300 freed inmates. The truck with Dov Landau raced up the coast road. It had been spotted by the British and was now trailed by a motor force that outnumbered its complement 10-1. The truck pulled into the Jewish town of Naharia. Nachum Ben-Ami fled with Dov toward the Lebanese border kibbutz of Ha-Mishmar, while the rest of the force deployed as a rear guard to stall the pursuers. These Maccabees managed to hold the British long enough to allow Nachum Ben-Ami to lead Dov to safety. But it was a suicide action. All 17 men and women of the rear guard were killed. Akiva and Ari were in the back seat of the staff car. The driver and another Maccabee sat in front. They sped from the Aku area along an inland road toward the kibbutz Kfar Masaryk. At Napoleon's Hill, a Maccabee roadblock waved them down and told them to get off the main road, which was mined against British counterattack. This group was holding off 2 British companies trying to break through to Aku. Ari made a quick decision.
Driver, can you drive through the fields here and get past that British unit?
We'll find out.
They careened off the road and banged and rattled through a field to encircle the area of action. They managed to get past the 2 British companies and turned again for the highway. 12 soldiers chased after the car, firing as they ran. Just as the car touched the road again, it swerved under the impact of a hail of bullets. Ari grabbed Akiva and held him down on the floor. The whine of bullets was all around them. The wheels of the car spun furiously, digging in the dirt for more traction. The driver threw the car into reverse as more bullets ripped into it. 2 soldiers with submachine guns were almost on them. Ari fired through the back window. 1 of the soldiers dropped. The 2nd opened up with a deadly burst of fire. Ari could see the red flames spit from the mouth of his gun. Akiva shrieked. Another burst spewed from the soldier's gun. Ari fell on top of Akiva just as the car regained the road and raced away.
Are you all right back there?
We've both been hit.
Ari pulled himself up and examined his right leg. He felt the inside of his leg. It was numb. The bullet had lodged deep. There was no bad bleeding or great pain, only a burning sensation. He knelt and rolled Akiva over and ripped his bloody shirt open. Akiva's stomach was a gaping wound.
How is he?
Bad. Very bad.
Akiva was conscious. He pulled Ari close to him.
Ari, he said, am I going to make it?
No, uncle.
Then get me to some hidden place. You understand.
I understand, Ari said.
The escape car reached Kfar Masaryk, where a dozen kibbutzniks stood by ready to hide the car and provide a truck to continue the escape. Akiva was gory and unconscious by the time they pulled him from the car. Ari took a moment to pour sulfur into his wounded leg and put a pressure bandage on it. The two Maccabees with him pulled him aside.
The old man is not going to make it if we go any farther. He must stay here and receive medical treatment.
No, Ari said.
Are you mad?
Now listen to me, you two. He has no chance to live. Even if he did, the British would find him here. If we leave him and he dies here, it will be known all over Palestine. No one but us must know that Akiva did not escape. The British must never know he is dead.
The two Maccabees nodded their understanding. They jumped into the front of the truck, and Ari got into the rear with his uncle. Ari's leg was beginning to hurt. The truck streaked south below Haifa. It ascended the narrow roads working up the side of Mount Carmel. Ari held his unconscious uncle in his lap as they bounced on the dirt roads and swayed around treacherous turns, sending up a trail of dust and jolting them unmercifully. Higher and higher into Mount Carmel they drove, until they were in the territory where only the Druses lived, in isolation. Akiva opened his eyes. He tried to speak, but he was unable to. He recognized Ari, and he smiled, and then sagged in Ari's arms. The truck pulled into a clump of brush a mile before the Druze mountain village of Daliat El Karmil. Musa, a Druze Haganah soldier, waited with a donkey cart. Ari crawled from the truck. He rubbed his leg. He was drenched with the blood of Akiva. Musa rushed to him.
I'm all right, Ari said. Get Akiva. He is dead.
The tired old body of Akiva was carried from the truck to the cart.
You two men are Maccabees. You are not to reveal Akiva's death to anyone but Ben Moshe or Nahum. Now get the truck down from here and get it cleaned. Musa and I will bury my uncle.
The truck sped away. Ari got on the donkey cart. It bypassed the village and moved to the highest point on Mount Carmel, the South Ridge. At twilight, they entered a small forest that held the altar of the greatest of all the Hebrew prophets, Elijah. It was on this ground that Elijah had proved the power of God against Jezebel's priests of Baal. The altar of the prophet Elijah looked down on the Israel Valley. The valley below stood as an eternal reminder that the land had not been forgotten. Musa and Ari scratched out a shallow grave near Elijah's altar.
Let's get that red suit off of him, Ari said.
The British hanging clothes were removed, and Akiva was rolled into his grave, and it was filled up and the spot covered with branches. Musa returned to the cart to wait for Ari. Ari knelt for a long time over Akiva's grave. Yaakov Rabinsky had been born in anger, and he had died in sorrow. After so very many years of torment, he could at last find peace. He could find here a peace that had avoided him in life, and he could sleep eternally, looking down upon the land of the Jews. Someday, Ari thought, all the world will know where Akiva sleeps, and it will be a shrine of all Jews.
Goodbye, uncle, Ari said. I didn't even get a chance to tell you that your brother forgives you.
Ari stood up and began to sway. Musa rushed over to him as he cried out in pain and pitched to the ground in a faint. Chapter 17. Kitty and Dr. Lieberman were both glum as she went over some business in his office.
I wish I knew the words that would make you stay, Dr. Lieberman said.
Thanks, Kitty said. Now that the time is here, I feel very empty.
I didn't realize how attached I'd become to Gandalfna. I was up most of the night going through these files. Some of these youngsters have made remarkable progress in light of their histories.
They will miss you.
I know, and I will miss them. I'll try to get everything up to date in the next few days. There are a few special cases I'd like to go over with you personally.
Yes, of course.
Kitty stood up to leave.
Be sure to get to the dining room a half hour early tonight.
I would prefer it if they didn't. I don't think the occasion calls for a going-away party.
The little hunchback held up his hands.
Everyone insisted. What could I do?
Kitty walked to the door and opened it.
How is Karen?
Pretty badly upset. She has been since she saw Dove at the prison. I had a bad night with her last night when we heard about the Akko jail raid. Maybe she will learn soon whether or not he escaped. That poor child has been through enough suffering for a lifetime. It may take a while, Dr. Lieberman, but I am going to make her very happy in America.
I wish it were in my heart to tell you that I think you are wrong for leaving us. I cannot say that.
Kitty left his office and walked down the corridor, thinking about the news that had electrified the world. The Maccabees had lost 20 men and women, killed, and another 15 were captured. No one knew how many wounded were in hiding. Ben Moshe had been killed. It seemed like a high price to pay for two lives, until one considered that they were not just any two lives. The raid had been a crushing blow to what was left of British morale and British desire to remain in Palestine. Kitty stopped before Jordana's door. She hated the idea of confronting Jordana. She knocked.
Yes?
Kitty entered. Jordana looked up from her desk coldly.
I was wondering, Jordana, do you happen to know if Dov Landau made his escape yesterday? I mean, with Karen's attachment to the boy, it would make her feel much better if... I don't know.
Kitty started to leave, then turned at the last second.
Was Ari on the raid? Ari doesn't give me a list of his raids. I thought you might know. How should I know? It was a Maccabee raid. You people have ways of obtaining information about things you want to learn. If I knew, I wouldn't tell you, Mrs. Fremont. You see, I want nothing to stand in the way of your catching your plane out of Palestine. It would be much nicer if we could part friends. But it doesn't look as though you are even going to give me a chance for that.
She turned quickly and left the office and walked out to the main door. Kitty could hear whooping and cheering coming from a football game on the athletic field. Out on the center green, some of the younger children played tag, and some of the older ones lay on the lawn studying. The flowers never stopped blooming at Gandalfna, Kitty reflected, and the air was forever filled with their scent. Kitty walked down the steps of the administration building and crossed the green, past the trenches. She stopped by the statue of Daphna. This time she did not feel jealous of Ari's dead sweetheart. She looked down on the hula, as Daphna always looked down on it, and she felt a sudden twinge of loneliness.
Shalom, Gveret Kitty,
some youngsters called to her as they ran past. One of them ran up to her and threw his arms around her waist, and she mussed his hair and sent him along. As she walked to the hospital, she felt very depressed. Leaving Gandalfna was going to be more difficult than she had thought. In her office, she began to go through her files, discarding some, sorting others. It was strange, she thought. She had not felt this loss in leaving the orphanage in Salonika. Kitty never really tried to become a friend of the Jews at Gandalfna. Why was it all catching up to her at this moment? Perhaps it was because it was the end of an adventure. She would miss Ari Ben Canaan, and she would think about him for a long time, maybe forever. But in time, things would become sane and organized again, and she would be able to give Karen all those things in life she wanted for the girl. There would be good times and wonderful vacations together, and Karen would start her dancing lessons again. In time, the picture of Ari Ben Kanan would grow dim, as would the memory of Palestine. It was natural to feel badly, Kitty reasoned. There is a certain regret in leaving any job and moving from place to place. She began reading through her personal notes on some of her children. Were they impersonal objects of prescribed therapies? Or were they little lost human beings who were dependent upon her? Did she have the right to take them up and just drop them? Or did she have a further duty to them, beyond her own personal desires? Kitty quickly shut her mind to this line of thought. She opened her desk drawer and took out her passport. Karen's British passport was beside her own. There were two tickets. Departure, Lydda. Destination, New York. Mark Parker was coming in from the Orient to meet them in San Francisco. Dear Mark, was there ever a more devoted friend? Mark would help Kitty get situated around San Francisco. Kitty loved the Bay Area. They could live in Marin County over the Golden Gate Bridge, or in Berkeley near the university. They would be near the theater and ballet and the wonderland of San Francisco. Kitty shut her desk drawer. She picked up the files again and started to replace them in the cabinet. Of course it was right for her to go. Of course it was. Even Dr. Lieberman said so. What did she owe these children? It was a job. Nothing more, nothing less. Kitty closed the drawer to the file cabinet and sighed. Even as she justified it to herself, the shadow of doubt began to creep into her mind. Was she really doing this for Karen? Or was she going because of her own selfish love for the girl? Kitty turned and gasped. An Arab was standing in the doorway. He was dressed oddly. He wore an ill-fitting Western suit of pinstriped worsted. On his head was a red fez, bound in white cloth, that gave his head a square look. His black mustache was enormous and waxed to fine points.
"I did not mean to frighten you," the Arab said. "I may come in?"
"Certainly," Kitty said, surprised to hear him speak in English. She surmised that he was from a nearby village and that someone was sick. The Arab entered and closed the door behind him.
"You are Mrs. Fremont?"
"Yes."
"I am Musa. I am a Druze. You know of the Druzes?"
She knew vaguely that they were an Islamic sect that lived in villages on Mount Carmel, south of Haifa, and that they were loyal to the Jews.
"Aren't you a long way from home?"
"I am Haganah."
Kitty sprang to her feet instinctively.
"Ari,"
she said.
"He hides in my village of Daliat El Carmil. He led the raid at Akko. He asks that you come to him."
Kitty's heart pounded wildly.
"He has been badly wounded," Musa said. "You will come?"
"Yes,"
she said.
"Do not take medicine. We must be cautious. There are many British roadblocks, and if they find medicine, they will be suspicious. Ari says to get the truck filled with children. Tomorrow there is a Druze wedding. We tell the British we are bringing the children to the ceremony. I have a truck. Get 15 children right away and have them pack bedrolls."
"We will be ready in 10 minutes, she said,
and rushed out for Dr. Lieberman's office. It was 80 kilometers from Gandafna to Musa's village, mostly over narrow mountain roads of northern Galilee. The dilapidated truck made slow progress. The children in the back, delighted with the unexpected holiday, sang at the top of their voices as the truck chugged through the hills. Only Karen, sitting in the front cabin with Kitty, knew the real nature of the journey. Kitty pumped Musa for information. All she was able to ascertain was that Ari had received a leg wound 24 hours ago was unable to walk, and was in great pain. He knew nothing of Dov Landau, and said nothing of the death of Akiva. In spite of the instructions, Kitty had packed a small first aid kit of sulfur, bandages, and iodine, which would appear innocent enough in the glove compartment. She had known real, deep fear only twice in her life. She knew fear in Chicago in the waiting room of the polio wing of the Children's Hospital during the 3 days and three nights of Sandra's crisis. She knew fear once again as she waited in the Dome Hotel for news of the hunger strike on the Exodus. She knew fear now. She was oblivious to the children's singing or to Karen's efforts to keep her calm. She was dazed with anxiety. She closed her eyes and her lips moved, and she said the words to herself over and over. Whoever this God is who watches Israel, keep Ari alive. Please let him be alive. An hour passed, and two, and three. Kitty's nerves had brought her to a state of near exhaustion. She laid her head on Karen's shoulder and closed her eyes. The truck rattled into the turn at Kfar Masaryk, using the roads that Ari had taken in his escape from Akko. As they moved toward Mount Carmel, the roads came alive with troops. They were stopped at a roadblock.
These children from Gandafna. We have wedding at Deliat tomorrow.
Out, everyone, the British ordered. They combed the truck. All the bedrolls were untied and searched thoroughly. Two of them were ripped open with knives. The underneath of the truck was searched and the spare tire torn off the rim. The motor was looked over and the children were searched. The shakedown took nearly an hour. A second British search took place at the foot of Mount Carmel. Kitty was played out by the time Musa began to drive up the winding turns along the sides of Mount Carmel.
All Druze villages are built very high places. We are a small minority and need high places to defend against Muslim attacks, Musa said. We will be in Deliat in few minutes.
Kitty pulled herself together quickly as they approached the outskirts and slowed in the narrow streets. Deliat El Carmel seemed to sit on the roof of the world. It was sparkling white and clean in comparison to the filth and decay of most Arab villages. Most of the men wore mustaches, and many wore Western clothing. Their headdresses were somewhat different from those of other Arabs, but the most dramatic difference was the carriage of dignity and outward pride, and the look, which suggested that they could be fierce fighters. The women were exceedingly handsome, and the children were bright-eyed and sturdy. The women were dressed in wild colors with white cloths over their heads. Deliat teemed with hundreds of visitors. They had come for the wedding from all the Carmel Druze villages, and in addition, there were Jews from the kibbutz and as far away as Haifa. The truck inched past the village reception house where solid lines of male guests gathered to congratulate the groom and the village elders. Alongside the reception house, a veranda was built over the hillside. It held a 25-yard-long table filled with fruits and rice and curried lamb and wines and brandies and stuffed marrows. The women, balancing dishes of food on their heads, kept a steady stream moving to and from the table. Musa stopped the truck beyond the reception house. A half-dozen villagers came up to greet the children. The children unloaded the back of the truck and marched off with their bedrolls to their camping area to set up their camp and then return to join the festivities. Musa, Kitty, and Karen drove on down the center street. Here, Druze dancers wearing silver silk shirts and multicolored embroidered skullcaps were in the middle of a wild performance. They were lined up, each with his hands on the next man's shoulders. Keeping the line straight, they continuously bounced from the ground, holding their bodies rigid, using only their feet as springs. In front of the line, the finest Druze dancer in Palestine, a man named Nisim, went through wild gyrations with one knife in his teeth and a pair of knives in his hands. Nearby, at the sanctuary, a verse-maker told a story by calling out extemporaneous chants. Each line of the chant was repeated by 100 men around him. As his story unfolded, each new line was repeated louder and louder, and as he came toward the end of his legend, half the men drew pistols and fired them into the air. Musa turned the truck off the main street and took a narrower street down a steep incline. He jammed the transmission into low gear and held his foot on the brake as the vehicle slid down. At the bottom of the grade, Musa stopped the truck. The next road was too steep to attempt. The three of them got out quickly. Kitty took the small first aid kit and followed Musa down past a block of houses until they were far from the frenzied town activity. At the last house in the village, they stopped. It was closely guarded by a small band of fierce-looking armed Druze men. Musa held the door open. Kitty took a deep breath and entered. Inside, another pair of guards stood before an inner door. She turned to Karen.
Stay here. I'll call you if I need you. Musa, come in with me, please.
The bedroom was almost dark, and it was chilly because of the altitude and the concrete floors. Kitty heard a groan. She walked quickly to the window and threw the shutters open, admitting a stream of light. Ari lay on a double bed with a brass headboard. His fists were clenched around two of the rungs, which he had bent out of shape as he writhed in agony. Kitty threw the cover from him. His clothes and the mattress were dark with blood.
Help me take his pants off, Kitty ordered.
Musa straightened up with amazement.
Never mind, she said. Just stand out of my way. I'll tell you when I need you.
She carefully ripped away his trousers and examined him. His color seemed good, and his pulse was relatively strong. She compared the two legs. The bad one did not seem to be unduly swollen, nor did it appear that he had lost an excessive amount of blood. Kitty's manner was brisk efficiency now that she knew Ari was alive and did not appear to be in critical danger.
Musa, bring me some soap and water and some clean towels. I want to take a closer look at the wound.
She washed her hands and wiped around the wound carefully. His thigh was discolored, and the blood oozed from the puffy spot where the bullet had entered. Ari fluttered his eyes open.
Kitty?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank God.
What have you done for this thing?
I put some sulfur on it yesterday. I had a pressure bandage, but it didn't seem to be bleeding too much.
I'm going to poke around. It's going to hurt.
Go ahead.
He grunted and broke out in a cold sweat as she felt the lump. He gripped the brass rungs and shook the bed. Kitty took her hand away quickly. Ari trembled for 3 minutes. She wiped his face with a wet towel.
Can you talk to me, Ari?
It's going away, he said. It comes and goes. This is a lot of fuss I'm making for a leg wound. Did your Cook County training include this sort of thing?
Kitty smiled that he should remember.
Oh, every once in a while, somebody's husband caught the boyfriend in the act, and he was dumped at the emergency door.
What is it?
I can't say for sure. Bullets do funny things. There's no accounting for the way they twist. Your pulse and breathing are good. No shock. Your leg isn't swollen except around the immediate area of the wound.
What does that mean?
I would say it means you haven't had an internal hemorrhage. The bullet missed a main artery. I can't see any infection either. I'd say you were rather lucky, although I'm worried about this pain you're having.
I've been passing out every few hours, he said.
Hold on. I want to feel around again.
Ari braced himself, but was only able to take the probing for a few seconds. He cried out and bolted up to a sitting position, and then gasped and sank down.
The son of a bitch is killing me.
He clutched the sheets and rolled over on his face and shook. He convulsed in pain for 10 minutes, then fell limp.
Kitty, what is it? For God's sake, I can't take much more.
Were you able to walk at all after you were hit?
Yes. What is it, Kitty? Why should it hurt like this?
She shook her head.
I'm not a doctor. I can't say for sure. I may be all wrong.
Tell me what you do know,
he gasped.
All right. This is what I think. The bullet entered your outer thigh and hit the bone. It didn't break your leg or you couldn't walk, and it didn't pass to the inside of your thigh, or it probably would have got an artery.
What is it?
I think it hit the bone and either chipped or splintered it. That's one of the things that is hurting you. My guess is that the bullet ricocheted back toward the surface. It may be lodged against a nerve.
What's going to happen?
It has to come out. That pain is either going to kill you or paralyze you. You can't take a trip down the mountain. It may start all sorts of things going. A hemorrhage, God knows what. You'll have to get a doctor up here in the next few hours, or you're going to be in very bad trouble. That bullet has to come out.
Ari looked over to Musa. Kitty turned and looked at the Arab, and then quickly to Ari.
There are wounded men from yesterday's raid hiding all over the Galilee, Musa said. Every Jewish doctor in Palestine is being watched right now. If I try to bring one back up here for Ari, he is certain to be followed.
She stared from one to the other again and stood up and lit a cigarette.
Then you'd better give yourself up and get this taken care of right away.
Ari nodded to Musa, and the Arab walked from the room.
Kitty,
he called. She walked to the side of the bed. He reached out and took her hand.
They'll hang me. It's up to you.
Her throat went dry. She pulled away and leaned against the wall and tried to think. Ari was calm now, and his eyes were fixed on her.
I can't. I'm not a doctor.
You've got to.
There is nothing to work with.
You've got to.
I can't. I can't. Don't you see it will be so painful it might put you into shock? Ari, I'm frightened.
She slumped into a chair. She thought of Ari's leading the raid and knew he was right about his fate if the British were to find him. She thought of Dov, and how Karen had felt. She knew that she was his only hope. To do nothing was equally courting death. She bit her clenched fingers and stood up quickly. There was a bottle of brandy on the dresser. She took it to him.
Start drinking this. When this bottle is empty, we'll get you another one. Get drunk. Get as drunk as you can, because I'm going to hurt you like hell.
Thanks, Kitty.
She opened the door quickly.
Musa!
Yes?
Where can we get some medical supplies?
At the Yagur Kibbutz.
How long will it take to get a man there and back?
Getting him there is no trouble. Coming back, he must not use the roads, so he cannot take a car. By foot in these mountains will take many hours. Maybe not even till late tonight.
Look, I'll write you a list of things that I will want. You get a man to that kibbutz as fast as you can.
Kitty considered. The messenger might get back tonight, and he might not get back at all. A kibbutz dispensary might or might not have anesthetics, but she could not take the chance of waiting. She wrote a note for 2 liters of plasma, vials of penicillin, morphine, dressings, a thermometer, and some other instruments. Musa dispatched one of the guards to Yagur.
Karen, I'm going to need your help. But it is going to be very rough. I can't do anything. Good girl. Musa, do you have anything at all in the way of medicine?
A few things, not much.
Very well. We'll make do with what we have in that first aid kit. Do you have a flashlight and perhaps some unused razor blades or a very sharp small knife?
Yes, we can get that.
All right, fine. I want the razor blades and the knife boiled for a half hour.
Musa turned and issued the order.
Now, put some blankets on the floor. The bed is too springy. He will have to be braced solidly. When we move him to the floor, Karen, you get those dirty linens off and change the bed. Musa, get her some clean sheets.
Is there anything else? Musa asked.
Yes. We will need 6 or 8 men in here to move him and to hold him still.
Everything was made ready. Blankets were laid out on the floor. Ari was drinking steadily. 4 of the Druses moved him as gently as possible to the floor. Karen quickly took off the bloody sheets and remade the bed. The blades and knife were brought in. Kitty scrubbed her hands and washed the wound area and painted it with iodine. She waited until the brandy had Ari mumbling incoherently, then placed a pillow beneath his head and placed a handkerchief in his mouth for him to bite on.
All right, she said. I'm ready. Hold him down and let's get going.
One man held Ari's head. 2 men held each arm, 2 held the good leg, and 1 held the bad one. The 8 Druses had Ari pinned solidly to the floor. Karen stood at the edge of the group with the flashlight, brandy, and the meager supplies at hand. Kitty got on her knees and knelt close to the wound. Karen turned the flashlight on it. Kitty took a razor blade in her fingers and motioned the men to get ready. She pressed the blade against his thigh and lined up her stroke. With 1 quick, hard motion, she slit deeply into his flesh and opened it in a 2-inch cut over the bullet hole. Ari shook violently. Mucus poured from his nose, and his eyes ran with tears of agony. The men strained to hold him. Karen saw the blood leave Kitty's lips, and her eyes started to roll. She grabbed Kitty's hair and pulled her face up and poured brandy down her throat. Kitty gagged a second and caught herself and took another drink. Ari's eyes rolled back into his head. He fell into blessed unconsciousness. Karen turned the light on the incision once again. With 1 hand, Kitty held the skin apart. With her other thumb and 3rd finger, she dug into his flesh and felt around for the bullet. Her fingernail rubbed the hard object. With a final exertion of strength, she gripped it and wiggled it loose from his leg. She sat on the floor and held the bullet up and looked at it and began laughing. All the Druse men started laughing too. Kitty sobbed half hysterically.
Musa, Karen said, get him back on the bed quickly. Don't let anything touch that wound.
Karen helped Kitty to her feet and sat her down in a chair. She pried the bullet from her hands and wiped them clean. The girl moved over to Ari and poured sulfur powder into the wound and laid a bandage over the top of it lightly. Then she sponged Ari down. Kitty remained crumpled and sobbing. Karen ordered everyone from the room and poured another drink for Kitty and left. Kitty sipped the brandy and walked over to Ari and felt his pulse. She pried his eyes open and watched his color.
Yes, he was going to come through all right.
She laid her head on his chest.
Ari, 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 Ari.
She whispered between sobs. Chapter 18. Ari remained in excruciating pain. The medicines failed to arrive. Kitty was unable to leave him for a second. Several times she had to call Musa for men to keep Ari from thrashing around and endangering the open wound. Up the hill in the center of the village, the dancing and chanting and hilarity continued. The bride, who had been hidden all day, was taken from seclusion. The groom, dressed in a cutaway coat and top hat, mounted a horse and rode to her through a flower-strewn lane, flanked with rifle-bearing Druze men. After the ceremony, many of the Jewish visitors, with the children from Gandafna, lit a campfire, and there were more songs and a hora. There was Hebraic dancing to the tambour and flute, and the Druze dancers, too, took their turn in the center ring. Karen remained constantly in the outside room. She came in to spell Kitty for intervals during the long night. Morning found both of them exhausted from the lack of sleep and the prolonged tension. Kitty sat at the edge of the bed and sprang up each time Ari groaned or moved. By morning, the medicines still had not arrived.
"You had better take the children back to Gandafna," Kitty told Musa. "Is there anyone else here who speaks English?"
"Yes. I will have him stay here."
"Good. Can you get another bed set up, or a couch, or something for me to rest on? I'll have to remain right here for some time."
"It will be arranged."
Kitty went into the next room where Karen dozed on a bench. She brushed the girl's cheek gently. Karen sat up and rubbed her eyes.
"Is he all right?"
"No. He is in very bad pain. I want you to go back to Yad El with the children this morning."
"But, Kitty, don't argue.
Tell Dr. Lieberman I have to stay here until I can get things under control."
"We are supposed to leave Palestine the day after tomorrow."
Kitty shook her head. "Cancel our flight. We can make new travel arrangements later. I have to stay here until they can get someone else up here to take care of him properly. I don't know how long it's going to be."
Karen embraced Kitty and turned to leave.
"Karen, get to Svat, will you, and tell Bruce Sutherland where I am. Ask him if he will come to Haifa to meet me. Tell him to stay at the largest hotel. I'll find it, whatever it is. Have him bring some clothes for me."
By noon, the hundreds of celebrants began drifting away from Deliat al-Karmil. The Druses left for their mountaintop villages, and the Jews went back to the kibbutz and to Haifa. Musa took the truckload of children back toward Gandafna. When they were all gone, the Druses relaxed the heavy guard around Ari. The English-speaking Druze stood by in the next room. Kitty Fremont was alone with him in this strange place. In this first moment of quiet, the full impact of these events hit her. She stood over his bed and looked at him.
"God Almighty,"
she whispered,
"what have I done?"
All the months of fighting him, all the carefully built-up resistance, collapsed in that mad second that had sent her rushing to his side. At this moment she feared this power that Ari held over her. Late in the evening, the messenger arrived with medicines from Yagur Kibbutz. He had been working his way through the mountains and hiding for long periods of time. British patrols were everywhere looking for the wounded from the Akko jail raid. Kitty quickly administered a liter of plasma to Ari and filled him with penicillin as insurance against the infection that she feared must be inevitable under the circumstances of the operation. She redressed the open wound and injected morphine to ease the murderous pain. For the next 2 days and nights, Kitty kept Ari under morphine sedation to block off the pain. She watched his progress from minute to minute. The incision was beginning to bind together. There appeared to be no great crisis. Ari was awake only for brief moments, during which he took some nourishment. But when he was awake, he was too torpid to realize what was taking place around him. The Druze villagers marveled at Kitty's nursing efficiency and stamina. The women were particularly pleased with the way she snapped out orders to the men. By the time Kitty knew Ari was safe, that time was the only requirement, she had become uncertain and filled with anxiety. The question of leaving Gandafna was in her mind again. She pondered again her right to leave the children of Gandafna who needed her. Where was the line between professionalism and humanity? And what of Karen? Was Karen coming to America only out of fear of losing Kitty? Of the thoughts that weighed on Kitty, the worst was a factor she could no longer rationalize. Once before, she had been drawn into this strange group of people against her will. On Cyprus, she had resolved not to work for them. And then she saw Karen. Now it appeared to be a repetition. On the eve of her departure, she was pulled back to Ari. Was this a coincidence? Or was her fate being shaped by a higher power? As much as her basic common sense resisted the fantastic idea, it kept haunting Kitty. She feared the power of Palestine. Ari made swift progress under Kitty's ministrations. He was a remarkable man, Kitty reflected. The pain that he had borne could have killed an ordinary human being. By the end of the fourth day, she had reduced the morphine sharply. She had also discontinued the use of penicillin, certain that the wound was healing and would not become infected. Ari awoke on the fifth morning, hungry, eager to shave and clean up, and in a cheerful frame of mind. As Ari emerged in renewed vitality, Kitty went into a shell. She adopted an icy, impersonal, clinical attitude. She snapped orders like a sergeant major, prescribing the next week's plans as though he were a complete stranger.
I hope by the end of this week to have you completely off drugs. I want you to start exercising the leg and give it as much motion as possible. However, you must be very careful about putting too much strain on the incision. It isn't stitched.
How long before I'll be able to walk?
I can't say without an X-ray. I'm inclined to think the bone was just cracked and not chipped. If there was a chip, you would still be in severe pain. However, I can safely say that you aren't going anywhere for at least a month.
Ari whistled under his breath as she pulled the sheet up around him.
I'm going out for a walk, she said. I'll be back in a half hour.
Kitty, just a moment. Look, you've been very kind. You've watched over me like an angel. Since this morning you have seemed angry. Is there something wrong? Have I done something?
I'm tired. I'm worn out. I've been up for 5 nights. I'm sorry I can't do a song and dance for you.
That's not it. There's something more. You're sorry you came here, aren't you?
Yes, I am,
she said softly. Do you hate me?
Hate you, Ari? Haven't I made it quite obvious how I feel about you? Please, I'm tired.
What is it? Tell me.
I despise myself for caring for you. Is there anything else you want to know?
You can be a terribly complicated woman, Kitty Fremont.
I suppose I am.
Why do you and I always have to confront each other with our guards up, ready to swing, ready to run?
Kitty regarded him steadily for a moment.
Maybe because I don't live by your simple, uncluttered standards of I like you and you like me, so let's go to bed. Page 444 of the Palmach Manual. Boys and girls should not indulge in coyness. Women of Palestine, be forthright. If you love him, sleep with him.
We aren't hypocrites.
I'm not so advanced in my thinking as your Dana or your immortal Daphna.
Stop it,
Ari snapped.
How do you dare to imply that my sister and Daphne were tramps? Yordana has loved only one man in her life. Is it wrong to give her love when she does not know if either of them will be alive at the end of the week? Don't you think I would have preferred to live in peace at Yad El with my Daphne than have her killed by Arab gangs?
I don't live my life as a noble mission. It is very simple with me, Ari. I have to be needed by the man I love.
Let's quit this, Ari said. Haven't I made it plain to you that I needed you?
Kitty laughed shortly with bitterness. Yes, you needed me, Ari. You needed me on Cyprus to smuggle forged papers out of Karolos, and you needed me again to pull a bullet out of you. It is remarkable, that mind of yours. Even half dead and rolling in pain, you could figure out all the angles. You could plot out the course, fill the truck up with children to avoid suspicion. You didn't need me, Ari. You needed a candidate to get through the British roadblocks. I'm not blaming you, she continued. I am the number one damned fool. We all have our crosses to bear, and I guess you are mine. I just can't take it with the straight-faced unconcern of a Sabra.
Does that make it necessary to treat me like an animal?
Yes, because that's what you are. You're a mechanical animal, too infested with the second coming of the Israelites to be a human being. You don't know the meaning of giving love. You know only fighting. Well, I'm fighting you, Brother Ben-Kanan, and I'm going to beat you, and I'm going to forget you in spades.
Ari remained silent as she walked to the bed and stood over him with tears of anger welling in her eyes.
Some bright day, you're really going to need someone, and it's going to be a terrible thing because you don't have the capacity to truly ask for help.
Why don't you take that walk? He said.
I'm taking it, and I'm going to keep on walking. Good Nurse Fremont is through. Somebody from the Palmach will come up to take care of you in a few days. You'll live till then.
She spun around and opened the door.
Kitty, this great vision of a man you have, what do you want?
I want a man who knows what it is to cry. I feel sorry for you, Ari Ben-Kanan.
Kitty left Daliat El Carmil the same morning. Chapter 19. Bruce Sutherland had been waiting for Kitty at the Zion Hotel in Haifa for 2 days. It seemed to her that she had never been happier to see anyone. After dinner, Sutherland drove up to Har HaCarmel, the Jewish sector of the city, which was spread on the slopes of Mount Carmel. They went into a nightclub which was built with a view of Panorama Road, where the city below, the harbor, and the sweep of the bay could be seen to Akko and beyond it to the hills of Lebanon.
How's the girl?
Much better, thank you, Bruce. I do appreciate your coming.
She looked at the view.
I came up here to Har HaCarmel the first night I was in Palestine. Ari brought me up. I think our conversation had something to do with living with tension.
The Jews here have learned to live under the gun, the way you Americans live with baseball. It's made them a hard lot.
This place has got me so I can't think straight anymore. The more I try to reason, the more I am trapped by sentiment and unexplainable forces. I've got to get out of here before it swallows me up.
Kitty, we know that Dov Landau is safe. He is hiding up at Mishmar. I haven't told Karen yet.
I guess she's got to know. Bruce, what's going to happen here?
Who knows?
You think the UN will give in to the Arabs?
There will be a war.
There was a fanfare at the bandstand. A master of ceremonies came out and told a few stories in Hebrew, and then introduced a tall, handsome Sabra youth. The young man wore the traditional white shirt opened at the throat, and he had a black mustache and a small chain was around his neck, with a Star of David pendant. He strummed a guitar and sang a song of passionate patriotism about the Jews coming back to their promised land.
I must know what is going to happen at Gandafna.
The Arabs can raise an army of 50,000 Palestinians and perhaps 20,000 irregulars from over the border. There was a chap named Kawukchi who led irregulars in the 36 to 39 riots. He's already busy getting another gang of cutthroats together. It is easier to get arms to the Arabs than to the Jews. They have friendly territory all around them.
And the rest of it, Bruce? Kitty demanded.
The rest of it? Egypt and Iraq both have armies of around 50,000 men. There will be some Saudi Arabian troops in the Egyptian army. Syria and Lebanon will put another 20,000 men on the field. Transjordan has the Arab Legion, crack soldiers with the latest arms. According to present-day definitions, the Arabs do not have first-class armies. Nonetheless, they have many modern units with artillery, armament, and aircraft.
You advised the Haganah, Bruce. What did you tell them?
I told them to form a defense line between Tel Aviv and Haifa and try to hold that strip of territory. Kitty, the other side of the picture is not pretty. The Jews have 4,000 or 5,000 Palmach troops and a paper army of 50,000 in the Haganah, but they only have 10,000 rifles. The Maccabees can put 1,000 men out, no more, with light arms. They have no artillery, their air force is 3 Piper Cubs, and their navy is those illegal immigrant runners tied up at Haifa. The Jews are outnumbered in soldiers 40-1, in population 100-1, in equipment 1,000-1, and in area 5,000-1. The Haganah has turned down my advice and the advice of every military man who has told them to pull into a tight defense line. They are going to fight it out at every moshav, every kibbutz, every village. That means Gandafna too. Do you want to hear any more?
Kitty's voice was shaky. No, I have heard enough. Isn't it strange, Bruce? One night when I was up on Mount Tabor with those young Palmach people, I had the feeling that they were invincible. The soldiers of God. Firelight and moonlight does things to me.
It does to me too, Kitty. Everything I've ever learned in my life in the service tells me that the Jews cannot win. Yet when you see what they have done with this land, you are not a realist if you do not believe in miracles.
Oh, Bruce, if I only could believe that way.
What an army these Jews have. Boys and girls without guns, without rank and uniform, and without pay. The Palmach commander is all of 30 years of age, and his 3 brigade commanders are all under 25. But there are things no military man counts that the Arabs must reckon with. The Jews are willing to lose every man, woman, and child to hold what they have. How much blood are Arabs willing to pay?
Can they win? Do you really believe it?
Call it divine intervention, if you will. Or maybe. Let us say that the Jews have too many Ari Ben Canaans.
Kitty returned to Gandafna the next day. She was surprised to find Jordana Ben Canaan awaiting her in her office. The red-headed Sabra girl was ill at ease.
What do you want, Jordana? Kitty asked coolly. I'm going to be very busy. We learned what you did for Ari, Jordana mumbled awkwardly. And I want to tell you how grateful I am. It seems that your intelligence system is getting information through again. I'm sorry I had to delay my departure.
Jordana blinked but did not answer.
Don't take this personally, Kitty said. I would have done the same for a wounded dog.
Kitty made plans to leave. Then Dr. Lieberman induced her to remain an extra few weeks. Extra personnel had been brought in and needed training to handle 100 more children who had been smuggled into the country by Alia Bet. Housing was being put up as quickly as possible. Many of the new children were in bad shape, having been in DP camps for more than 2 years. Once more she made her travel plans. Soon there were but 2 days left before she and Karen were to depart from Gandafna and Palestine. At the end of August in the year 1947, the UNSCOP announced its majority and minority plans from Geneva. Each of the plans called for partition into separate Arab and Jewish entities, with Jerusalem to be an international territory. There was no doubt as to the moral issue, for the United Nations Special Committee on Palestine called for the immediate immigration of 6,000 Jews a month from the DP camps in Europe and the resumption of land sales to Jews. The Jews had begged that the Negev Desert be added to their state. The Arabs had millions of square miles of undeveloped wastelands. The Jews wanted this small piece of a few thousand square miles in the hope that they could redeem it. The United Nations Committee agreed. Weary from a half century of heartbreak and sellout, the Yishuv Central and World Zionists announced acceptance of the compromise. The partitioned area, even with the Negev Desert, was an abortion of a state. It was, in fact, three strips of territory linked together by narrow corridors resembling a chain of sausages. The Arabs had three strips of territory, larger in area, also linked by corridors. The Jews lost their eternal city, Jerusalem. They kept the Sharon and the parts of the Galilee they had pulled out of swamplands. The Negev was wasteland. What was the use of fighting it further? It was a monstrosity, but they accepted. The Jews answered.